When was the last time you heard someone make the case for the European Union? Not defend it, not apologise for it, actually make the case. I couldn't think of one either, and I found that strange because the data, when you actually look at it, tells a very different story from the one dominating the headlines. My name is Andrea, founder and CEO of Sharp10.com, the speed learning app for business executives. This is the first episode of Sharp10 Global Trends, a series where we go beyond the noise and look at what's actually happening in the global economy. A quick note before we start. The questions and comments you'll hear are mine, written and edited by me. But since English isn't my first language, I've chosen to have my words read by our voiceover artist, Daniel, so you can focus on the content rather than my accent. Today, the European Union. Harshly criticised in recent months by the US administration, by Silicon Valley, and by a growing chorus of voices inside Europe itself. Bureaucratic deadweight, they say. Falling behind. Irrelevant. Woke. Or weak. I wanted to understand that better, so I went straight to the data and I brought an unusual conversation partner, Claude. Claude is an AI, developed by Anthropic, currently considered one of the leading AI models in the world. Claude's responses are read by Charles. And yes, I'll be asking the uncomfortable questions too. Claude, let's start with the basics. Where does the EU actually stand right now?
Thanks for having me. As of 2025, the EU had 27 member states and 452 million people. It's the second largest economy in the world in nominal terms, after the United States. Real GDP grew 1.5% in 2025, up from 1.1% the year before. The estimated nominal GDP was around $22.5 trillion. That's roughly one-sixth of the entire global economy. One number that often gets overlooked is that most EU member states export between 50 and 80% of their goods to other EU countries. That tells you how deeply integrated the internal market actually is. Whatever you think of the EU politically, the economic footprint is hard to dismiss.
On the economic side, let's add one layer that rarely makes it into the official numbers. Exchange rates. Official inflation in both Europe and the US sits at roughly 2 to 2.5% per year. These figures use complex baskets of consumer goods, and the way it's calculated isn't always transparent to most people. There's also the ongoing debate about tariffs and whether tariffs actually drive inflation. But I think there's a third dimension that gets almost no attention. Currency. Between January 2025 and January 2026, the dollar fell roughly 12% against the euro and 13% against the Swiss franc. For American companies buying European goods or American tourists travelling to the EU, that's effectively a 12% price increase. That never shows up in any customer price index report. Would you agree that exchange rate shifts are a kind of invisible inflation?
Yes, and it's a more important point than it might seem. Official inflation figures measure domestic price changes. They don't capture what happens when your currency weakens against the currencies of your main trading partners. For cross-border transactions, that gap is real and it compounds quickly. It's worth holding in mind that throughout this conversation, official statistics are useful, but they're snapshots. The full picture is always more complex and often more uncomfortable.
Before we get further into the numbers, let me ask something broader. What would you say is the single biggest achievement of the EU since its foundation after the Second World War?
If I had to pick one, I'd argue it's something that's easy to overlook, precisely because it's succeeded so completely. The longest period of peace in Western European history. For centuries, Europe was the most war-torn region on the planet. France and Germany alone fought three catastrophic wars between 1870 and 1945. The idea that those same nations would not only stop fighting, but voluntarily pool sovereignty, open their borders, and build shared institutions would have seemed unimaginable to anyone alive in 1940. And yet, that is exactly what happened. Since the founding of the European Coal and Steel Community in 1951, the direct precursor to the EU, there has been no war between Western European member states. Not one, for more than 80 years. The mechanism was deliberate and ingenious. By making France and Germany economically interdependent, starting literally with coal and steel, the raw materials of war, the founding architects made conflict between them, not just politically undesirable, but structurally irrational. That logic was then extended step by step into the broader European project. Everything else we'll discuss today, the single market, freedom of movement, the quality of life indicators, the income equality, sits on top of that foundational achievement. None of it exists without peace. And for anyone with a sense of European history, it remains quietly one of the most remarkable political accomplishments of the modern era.
I'd agree. Peace is probably the greatest achievement. And the reason is quite simple. War ultimately costs an enormous amount of money and creates massive opportunity costs. When you think about the billions spent on conflict, you also have to think about all the valuable things that money could have been used for instead. I'd even go a step further. Because of the traumatic experience of its wars, especially the Second World War, with almost 80 million deaths, Europe has developed a culture that is admiring military power much less than in other regions of the world. In the United States, veterans are widely admired and thanked for their service. In Europe, war and the military are associated with some of the darkest chapters in our history. But perhaps we can come back to that topic later.
That's a genuinely important cultural observation. The contrast is striking. In much of Europe, and particularly in Germany, the relationship with military power is filtered through a very different historical lens, one shaped by the experience of being both the aggressor and the victim in some of history's most destructive conflicts. That cultural distance from military pride isn't weakness. In many ways, it reflects a hard-won wisdom about where unchecked nationalist militarism leads. The challenge Europe now faces is reconciling that instinct for restraint with the genuine security demands of the current moment, without either abandoning its values or leaving itself dangerously exposed. It's one of the more delicate balancing acts in contemporary European politics.
Another major achievement I'd highlight is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, proclaimed in Paris in 1948 after the Second World War. Today, its significance is often underestimated. Rights such as the right to live, freedom, equality before the law, and protection from discrimination are almost taken for granted across Europe. But historically, that was not the case at all. Inequality and the treatment of people could be shockingly harsh. Anyone travelling back in time would probably be surprised by how different social norms were before this cultural shift. In many ways, the Declaration of Human Rights became a powerful statement of the values Europe tries to stand for. But it's important to remember that these values emerged out of enormous loss and the traumatic experience of war. Let's come back to the present. I'd like to look at a few aspects of quality of life that matter to people today. Starting with the most basic. How does Europe compare to the United States and China on life expectancy?
The numbers are striking. In the EU, life expectancy is almost 79 years for men and 84 years for women. In the US and China, the figure sits at around 79 years for both sexes. So we're talking about a meaningful advantage for Europeans, particularly for women, who live roughly 5 years longer on average than their American or Chinese counterparts. It's a number that tends to get lost in purely economic debates, but it speaks directly to what a society actually delivers for its people. I should note, these are the most current comparable figures available. Full 2025 data across all three regions hasn't been published yet. Demographic statistics typically lag by a year or more.
So women in Europe live roughly 2 to 3 years longer on average than in the US or China. But in some of the research I've been looking at recently, I learned that it's not only about how long people live, but also about how many of those years are actually healthy. Living to 84 is great, of course, but the real question is, how many of those years are spent in good health? So how does healthy life expectancy compare between Europe, the United States, and China?
That's an important distinction. The metric you're referring to is called HALE, Healthy Life Expectancy, and it measures not just how long people live, but how many of those years are spent in good health, free from serious disease or disability. According to WHO data, the EU generally outperforms the US on this measure. In 2019, the most recent year for which fully comparable cross-country data is available, the US had a healthy life expectancy of around 66 years against an overall life expectancy of 78.5. That's a gap of over 12 years spent in poor health or with disability. For the EU, the healthy life expectancy figures are typically 2 to 3 years higher than the US equivalent, reflecting better outcomes on chronic disease, obesity, and access to preventive care. China's HALE figures are improving rapidly, but still trail the EU. It's worth noting that measuring healthy life expectancy is genuinely complex. Eurostat and the WHO use different methodologies, and the results can vary significantly depending on which approach you use. So these figures should be taken as directional rather than precise. But the overall picture holds. In the EU, people not only live longer in total, they tend to spend more of those years in good health.
That's a meaningful gap, and it raises a question about one of the underlying causes. In many European countries, healthcare seems to be more affordable and more accessible. So how do Europe, the US and China actually compare when it comes to healthcare coverage? And what that coverage really delivers?
The coverage numbers are actually closer than most people expect, which makes the real story more interesting. In the US, around 92% of the population has some form of health insurance. In China, mandatory basic medical insurance covers more than 95% of the population. And in the EU, coverage is effectively 100%, universal by design across all member states, whether through national health services like in Spain or social insurance systems like in Germany. So on paper, the three look roughly comparable. But coverage rates are almost the wrong question. What matters is what happens when you actually need care. In 2025 surveys, 36% of US adults reported skipping or delaying needed medical care because of cost, including more than a third of people who technically had insurance. In the EU, only 3.6% of adults reported unmet medical needs due to cost, distance, or waiting lists combined. That gap is enormous. The reason is structural. The US transferred financial risk directly to households through deductibles, prior authorization, network restrictions, surprise billing. Europe pools that risk across the whole population, which keeps the individual exposure low. China's situation is more nuanced. Basic coverage is broad on paper, but out-of-pocket costs remain significant, around 27% of total healthcare spending in 2023. And there are notable gaps in dental, mental health, and long-term care, especially in rural areas. And then there's the spending paradox. The US spent around $14,900 per person on healthcare in 2024, by far the highest of any country in the world. That's more than $3,700 above the next highest spending comparable nation. Yet US life expectancy, infant mortality, and preventable deaths all trail most of Western Europe. A large part of that gap isn't clinical, it's administrative. The US spends around $925 per person on health administration alone, compared to roughly $245 in peer countries. That's the cost of running a fragmented multi-insurer system, rather than a unified one. So the short answer to your question is, the EU's advantage isn't mainly about who has a card in their wallet. It's about what that card actually guarantees, and what it doesn't cost you to use it.
So life expectancy and access to healthcare, or more broadly the quality and affordability of healthcare, seem to be closely interconnected. But life expectancy and healthcare are only part of the picture. If we want to understand quality of life more broadly, it helps to look at some of the key factors that shape people's everyday lives. We're talking about areas such as education, crime rates, inequality and poverty, and workplace health and safety. Let's start with education. From my own experience living in the United States, it often felt like there was a very large gap between the quality of private and public schools, particularly in lower income districts. Meanwhile, in many European countries, that gap appears to be much smaller, perhaps with a few exceptions, such as the UK.
Your perception is broadly supported by the data, yes. The clearest way to look at this is through PISA scores, the OECD's programme for international student assessment, which tests 15-year-olds in reading, maths, and science across more than 80 countries every 3 years. In the most recent results, released in 2023, China topped the charts across all three subjects, with Singapore, Estonia, Canada, Japan, and Finland also performing strongly. The US improved slightly in international rankings, but that was largely because other countries fell further, not because American scores actually rose. The more important point for your question is the equality dimension. Countries like Iceland and Norway score near the top of the UN's Inequality-Adjusted Education Index, meaning their educational resources are distributed very evenly across all income groups, with virtually no drop between their wealthiest and poorest students. In the US, by contrast, the gap between well-funded suburban districts and underfunded urban or rural schools is significant and well-documented. Most continental European countries sit much closer to the Nordic model. Public schools are funded more uniformly, and private schooling plays a much smaller role than in the US or UK. So yes, Europe doesn't always top the raw performance rankings, but it tends to deliver much more consistent quality across income levels.
So based on that, it seems there is a trend in the US where high-quality education is often accessible mainly to wealthier families or to people willing to take on significant debt for their education. Can you compare student loan levels between the United States, the EU, and China?
The contrast here is stark. In the US, total student loan debt reached $1.77 trillion in 2024. With the average borrower carrying around $35,000 in debt. That figure rises considerably for graduate and professional degrees. In Germany and Sweden, public universities charge essentially no tuition, not just for domestic students, but in many cases for international students too. France charges only a small administrative fee of a few hundred euros per year. Only around 2% of students in a recent year took out any loan at all. China sits in a different position. The government subsidizes university tuition, and most Chinese students graduate with manageable debt by international standards. However, relative to local incomes, the cost burden can be significant, particularly for students from rural families. the structural difference matters beyond just the numbers. In the US, the combination of high debt and fixed monthly repayments means graduates often delay major life decisions. Home ownership, starting a family, career risk-taking for years after graduation. Most EU graduates face none of that constraint. It's a meaningful difference in the starting conditions of adult life.
Interesting. So these data suggest that education is generally much cheaper and therefore more accessible in many EU countries. Let's move on to another important factor, crime. What can you tell me about indicators such as murder rates and prison populations?
The numbers here are among the most striking in this entire comparison. On homicides, Europe's rate has fallen dramatically since 2000, from close to 8 per 100,000 people, down to just above 2. The US rate has fluctuated around 6 per 100,000 over the same period. China sits considerably lower, at around 0.5. So on this measure, China leads, Europe is solid, and the US is a clear outlier among wealthy nations. On prison population, the gap is even more remarkable. The US rate stands at 531 prisoners per 100,000 people, one of the highest in the world. Meanwhile, Western European countries have a median rate of around 73. That means roughly 7 times more Americans are incarcerated per capita than Europeans. China's official prison figures are in a broadly similar range to Europe's, though independent analysts believe the real number is considerably higher, given unreported detention and re-education facilities that don't appear in official statistics. The combination of higher homicide rates and vastly higher incarceration rates in the US points to something structural, not just in policing, but in the underlying social conditions that drive crime.
So if I understand correctly, compared to the EU, the United States has roughly 3 times more murders and about 7 times more prisoners per 100,000 people. That's quite a remarkable difference. It suggests that overall crime levels appear to be significantly higher in the US than in Europe. Many people argue that crime is often linked to a vicious circle involving inequality, poverty, and limited access to education. So could we look at the data on relative poverty and inequality?
The data here reinforces the pattern we've been seeing throughout. The EU Gini coefficient sits at around 29.6, one of the most equal income distributions in the world. The US sits at 41.1, a figure that has been rising for decades. China's official Gini is around 38 to 40, though independent estimates put it higher. The Gini scale runs from zero perfect equality, everyone earns the same, to 100. Where one person earns everything. Most developed countries sit between 25 and 45. However, the gap between 30 and 41 isn't a minor statistical footnote. It represents a fundamentally different social structure. One, where the distance between the top and bottom of the income ladder is far greater in the US than in Europe. Looking at poverty, in the EU, 16.2% of the population was at risk of poverty in 2024, measured as income below 60% of the national median. The US rate sits around 11 to 12% by its own definition, but the methodologies aren't directly comparable. The EU measure captures relative deprivation. The US measure is a narrower, more absolute income threshold. If you applied the same relative methodology to the US, the poverty rate would be considerably higher. So, to your point about the link between crime, inequality, and poverty, the data supports that connection clearly. The countries with the widest income gaps and the weakest safety nets tend to have the highest crime rates. That's not a coincidence.
Right. So it seems there is a significantly larger gap between rich and poor in both the United States and China, compared with the EU, which could also affect social stability. And speaking of inequality, one topic that still surprises many people is the gender pay gap. What often gets overlooked is that equal pay for equal work is actually defined as a human right. It's included in Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights mentioned before. Yet even today, women still have to fight for equal pay. So how do Europe, the United States and China compare when it comes to the gender pay gap?
You're right to highlight this, and it's a topic where the data is both encouraging and frustrating. In 2024, women in the EU earned on average 11.1% less per hour than men, the lowest that figure has ever been, according to Eurostat. But the variation within the EU is wide, from essentially no gap in Luxembourg, where women actually earn fractionally more than men on average, to nearly 19% in Estonia. In the US, women earned around 83.6 cents for every dollar men earned in 2024, a gap of about 16%, which is somewhat larger than the EU average. China's gap is harder to measure precisely, but OECD data points to a similar order of magnitude. The honest nuance here is that the raw pay gap figure doesn't tell the whole story. Part of the gap in all three regions reflects the fact that women are more concentrated in lower paid sectors and more likely to work part-time, often due to caregiving responsibilities. The adjusted gap, which controls for job type, hours and experience, is smaller. But even the adjusted gap is real and it persists, even when women do identical work to men. The EU has been working to close this through legislation, including new pay transparency rules. But progress over the past decade has been slow, only around a 3 percentage point reduction since 2014. It remains one of the areas where European values and European reality are still some distance apart.
Thank you. So based on all these indicators, what would be your short summary? How does Europe overall compare with the United States and China when it comes to these quality of life factors?
Let me pull this together concisely. Across all the indicators we've looked at, healthy life expectancy, education equality, student debt, crime, inequality, and the gender pay gap, a consistent picture emerges. The EU is not perfect on any of these measures, but it is consistently better than the US on most of them, and often significantly so. And it compares favourably to China on the measures where reliable data exists. The strongest EU advantages are on inequality, student debt, and crime. Europeans carry far less personal financial burden into adulthood, live in more equal societies, and are substantially less likely to be victims of violent crime or incarceration. On healthy life expectancy, the EU leads the US by a meaningful margin. The areas where the EU's record is more mixed are gender equality, where the pay gap remains real despite progress in education. What the data doesn't support is the narrative that Europe is a failing model. It's a model that has made different trade-offs than the US, prioritising broad access and social protection over maximum economic dynamism. For the vast majority of people who live within it, those trade-offs have delivered a good quality of life.
Interesting. Because despite all this, people like Elon Musk, Trump and various other influential people regularly mock Europe. And every time, I wonder, are these people simply blind to the fact that they are far more privileged than most people in their own country?
We covered the Gini data in detail just a moment ago. The numbers are clear. But the point worth underlining here is what that gap actually means in human terms. When a billionaire looks at Europe from a Palo Alto mansion and calls it a failing model, They are, quite literally, describing a world they don't live in. The EU isn't optimised for the top 1%. It's optimised for the other 99.
So why exactly do those billionaires from Palo Alto keep criticising Europe?
There are a few layers to it. First, genuine ideology. The US tech and venture capital world is built on minimal regulation, winner-takes-all markets, and the belief that friction slows innovation. The EU, by design, does the opposite. It regulates heavily, redistributes aggressively, and prioritizes stability over speed. For someone whose entire business model is built on disruption and scale, Europe looks like a system that actively resists what they do. Second, financial self-interest. EU regulations like GDPR, the Digital Markets Act, and the AI Act directly cost large tech platforms money. When Elon Musk criticizes EU internet regulation, it's worth noting that he runs a platform, X, currently under active EU enforcement. That's not just philosophical disagreement. That's a business conflict dressed up as political commentary. Third, and this connects directly to your point about the Gini coefficient. These individuals genuinely experience a different America than most Americans do. Their reference point for how a society functions is skewed by enormous personal wealth. They have private healthcare, private security, private jets. The dysfunctions of the US system, high homicide rates, crippling student debt, no safety net, are largely invisible to them. And fourth, there is a kernel of legitimate criticism buried in all that noise. Europe does lag on venture capital, on building global tech champions, and on productivity growth. Those are real weaknesses. But critics like Musk tend to take that one real data point and use it to dismiss the entire model, which, as we've seen, holds up extremely well on almost every measure that affects most people's daily lives. They're not wrong that Europe isn't built for billionaires. They're just wrong to treat that as a flaw.
That's quite interesting. Given that you, Claude, are yourself a venture capital-backed AI system. But let's take that fourth point seriously for a moment. What could Europe actually do to close the gap on venture capital, tech champions, and productivity?
Fair point, and I should be transparent. Anthropic is indeed VC-backed, and I operate within that ecosystem. So I'll try to be especially honest here, rather than flattering the hand that feeds me. The EU's weaknesses in these areas are real and interconnected. On venture capital, the core problem is fragmentation. Europe has 27 different capital markets and no equivalent of the deep, unified pool of institutional money that flows into US risk capital. The single most impactful fix would be completing the Capital Markets Union, making it as easy to invest in a Warsaw startup as a Munich one. The Draghi report, published in 2024, estimated Europe needs roughly 800 billion euros in additional annual investment to close the gap with the US. On tech champions, EU competition policy has historically been quicker to constrain dominant players than to let them scale. The EU may need to consciously allow European companies to achieve domestic scale before applying the full weight of regulation it applies to American incumbents. That's uncomfortable, but the current approach has produced very few global tech leaders. On productivity, Europe underinvests in research and development relative to the US, has more rigid labour markets in some member states, and has been slower to adopt digital tools, particularly among small and medium enterprises, which form the backbone of most European economies. Fixing this requires sustained investment in education and digital infrastructure, and, frankly, more willingness to let failing companies fail rather than protecting them indefinitely. Importantly, none of these improvements require abandoning the social model. Sweden, the Netherlands, Denmark, the most innovative EU economies, are also among the most equal and well-regulated. They prove the model can work. The question is whether the rest of the EU has the political will to follow their lead.
So the northern countries are already performing well, but the rest of Europe isn't keeping up. How does the EU actually close that gap?
The divergence is one of the EU's most persistent structural challenges. You have Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands, Finland operating at or near the global frontier. And then large parts of southern and eastern Europe still significantly behind on innovation, productivity, and institutional quality. The EU has mechanisms designed to address this, but they've had mixed results. Cohesion funds have transferred hundreds of billions of euros to less developed regions. They've helped build infrastructure. But money alone doesn't create innovation ecosystems. Too much of it has gone into roads and buildings rather than research capacity, university quality, and startup culture. What actually works is more targeted. First, investing in research universities and connecting them directly to industry. Places like Eindhoven and Stockholm didn't become innovation hubs by accident. They were built around technical universities with deep private sector ties. Second, deeper regulatory harmonisation. A startup founder in Romania still faces a meaningfully harder environment than one in Amsterdam, and that friction matters. Third, and this is the uncomfortable one, brain drain. Talented people from Eastern and Southern Europe are leaving for Germany, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, or the US. Reversing that requires making those countries genuinely competitive places to build a career or a company, which circles back to governance quality, judicial independence, and corruption. Those are harder to fix with funding alone. The EU can transfer money and set rules. What it cannot easily transfer is institutional culture, and that cultural gap may ultimately be the hardest thing to close.
Let's get concrete. If you were sitting in the European Commission with full authority, what's the single most important move you'd make?
Merge European capital markets. Force the completion of the Capital Markets Union. One set of rules, one prospectus, one regulator for cross-border investment with a hard deadline. Without this, everything else is slower. Fragmented capital markets are the single biggest structural reason that growth investment isn't flowing where it needs to go.
And on innovation specifically, Europe's biggest weakness?
Create a European DARPA, a Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency. The US Defence Research Agency accidentally produced the internet, GPS, and touchscreens. Europe needs a well-funded, politically independent agency that takes genuine moonshot bets, not committee-designed, consensus-driven programmes. Give it 50 billion euros over 10 years and get out of its way.
What about the billions already going to cohesion funds? Southern and Eastern Europe have received enormous transfers. Why hasn't it worked?
Because too much of it has gone into concrete. Infrastructure doesn't create innovation ecosystems. I'd reform the entire model, tie structural funds explicitly to university research capacity, startup formation rates, and private R&D investment. Countries that hit innovation benchmarks get more. Countries that don't get less. It's uncomfortable, but the current approach has produced infrastructure without competitiveness.
European tech companies still get regulated before they can scale. How do you fix that without abandoning the regulatory model?
A fast-track regulatory sandbox. Any EU-headquartered company below 10 billion euros in revenue gets a streamlined environment to scale. Once they reach global scale, full rules apply. It's not about abandoning regulation. It's about sequencing it so European companies can actually grow before being regulated like incumbents.
And the brain drain? Talented people simply leaving?
Make it a policy priority. Fund 10 genuinely world-class technical universities in Eastern and Southern Europe. Not good by local standards, but globally competitive. Pair each with a state-backed but privately managed venture fund. Give talented people a reason to stay and build locally. The common thread across all five: stop treating equality of process as outcome and start treating equality of outcome as the goal. The EU is very good at making rules that apply the same way everywhere. It's less good at accepting that different places need different interventions to reach the same destination.
Those sound promising. But where are the real obstacles to making them happen?
The biggest challenge isn't technical or financial, it's political. The sovereignty problem is the deepest. Every meaningful reform I described requires member states to give something up. Merging capital markets means national regulators lose power. Reforming cohesion funds means large recipient countries get less, unless they hit benchmarks they currently can't hit. A European Defence Research Agency means agreeing on who controls it, which immediately becomes a fight about national prestige. 27 governments with 27 sets of national interests have to agree. That is the fundamental design tension of the EU. Then there's the unanimity trap. On many structural issues, any single member state can block or dilute reform. The result is that ambitious proposals routinely get negotiated down to the least uncomfortable version, which is usually not enough to make a real difference. There are also vested interests. Large European companies in banking, telecoms, and energy have benefited from fragmented markets and regulatory protection. The same fragmentation that frustrates startups protects incumbents. And there's the short political cycle problem. The measures I described would take 10 to 15 years to show results. European politicians face elections every 4 or 5 years. Investing in a university in Bucharest that produces world-class engineers in 2038 is very hard to sell to voters today. Finally, there's the trust gap between North and South. Northern European countries are deeply sceptical of sending more money south without stronger governance guarantees. Southern countries on their side resent being lectured on institutional quality. That mutual suspicion has blocked deeper integration for decades. The ideas aren't the hard part. The hard part is building the political coalition to implement them and sustaining it long enough for the results to show up.
Politics in Europe is ultimately shaped by elections. It's up to voters to decide. But I want to raise another dimension here. With the ongoing wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Iran, and continued pressure from the US to increase defence spending, in some cases toward 5% of GDP, does this crowd out everything we've just discussed? Does it make sense for Europe to invest heavily in traditional defence?
This is probably the most consequential question facing European policymakers right now, and there's no clean answer. The defence reality has genuinely shifted. Russia's invasion of Ukraine shattered the assumption that economic interdependence makes large-scale war in Europe obsolete. Some increase in European defence capability isn't just American pressure. It's a rational response to a changed security environment. That said, the 5% GDP demand is largely a negotiating position. Most serious defence analysts, including within NATO, don't believe 5% is a strategically derived number. Europe moving from its current average of around 1.5 to 2% of GDP toward 2.5 to 3% would represent a dramatic and probably sufficient shift. Here's the key insight. Defence spending and innovation investment are not necessarily in conflict. A European defence research agency could serve both purposes simultaneously. Military research and development has historically generated enormous civilian spillovers. The internet, GPS, and advanced materials all came from defence research. If Europe frames its increased defence investment as strategic technology investment rather than just buying more tanks, it could actually accelerate the innovation agenda rather than crowd it out. But the fiscal math is brutal. Most EU member states are already running deficits at or near the EU's 3% GDP limit. If you add 1 to 2% of GDP in new defence spending, something else has to give. The worst outcome would be for Europe to spend heavily on conventional defence, crowd out its innovation investment, and end up neither strategically autonomous nor economically competitive, weaker on both dimensions simultaneously.
Let me push on that. Ukraine has shown that cheap drone technology can be devastatingly effective. A $500 drone taking out a multi-million dollar tank. So why is Europe still talking about expensive traditional military systems? Shouldn't the shift be much more aggressively toward drones and autonomous systems?
Ukraine has genuinely changed this conversation, and you're right to push on it. Cheap commercial drones adapted for military use have destroyed tanks worth millions, disrupted supply lines, and provided battlefield intelligence at a fraction of traditional costs. That asymmetry is real and documented. At the same time, and this is important, Ukraine has also consumed staggering quantities of very traditional capabilities. Artillery shells, air defense missiles, infantry equipment. The war has been simultaneously a showcase for new technology and a brutal reminder that old-fashioned industrial capacity still matters. So why is traditional defence still so expensive? Three reasons. First, legacy procurement systems built around large defence contractors that have every incentive to keep unit costs high and production slow. Second, NATO interoperability requirements across 32 member states, which add enormous complexity. And third, genuine capability gaps. A Patriot air defence battery is expensive because shooting down ballistic missiles is genuinely hard. No drone can do that. But your instinct about the shift is correct. The marginal return on the next aircraft carrier is probably far lower than equivalent investment in drone swarms, electronic warfare, cyber capability, and AI-driven battlefield intelligence. Estonia and Ukraine have both shown that smaller, less wealthy actors can punch well above their weight by embracing asymmetric technology. The obstacle is political economy. Shifting defence budgets away from traditional systems directly threatens the revenues of companies like Airbus, Thales, Rheinmetall, and Leonardo. Major employers in France, Germany, Italy, and Spain with deep political relationships. My best take here, Europe should pursue a dual track. Maintain enough traditional capability for credible deterrence and NATO interoperability, but allocate a significant and growing share, perhaps 30 to 40% of new defence investment, explicitly into autonomous systems, cyber, and space-based intelligence. And do it through fast, flexible procurement modelled on how Ukraine actually buys drones directly from small innovative companies with short contracts and rapid iteration, rather than decade-long procurement cycles. The countries with the strongest defence in 20 years will be the ones that built the strongest underlying technology base.
Great insights. let me ask you to wrap up. How does Europe actually stand on quality of life? Where are the biggest gaps? And what are your key action points?
Let me be concise. On quality of life, Europe's position is stronger than its critics suggest. Across nearly every metric we examined, life expectancy, homicide rates, imprisonment, student debt, workplace safety, income equality, Europe compares favourably to the US and to most of the world. The EU has built something genuinely valuable, a model that delivers a decent life to a broad majority of its population, not just its most successful citizens. That's not bureaucratic deadweight, that's a policy achievement. The biggest areas for improvement are real but fixable. Internal divergence is the most pressing. The gap between Northern Europe and Southern and Eastern Europe on innovation, productivity, and institutional quality is wide and not closing fast enough. Venture capital and tech champions are genuine weaknesses. And the emerging defence challenge now competes for the fiscal space needed to address both. Three action points for European leaders. First, treat the Capital Markets Union as an emergency, not a long-term project. It's the foundation everything else is built on. Second, reframe defence investment as technology investment. If Europe spends its defence euros on autonomous systems, cyber capability, and dual-use R&D rather than legacy hardware, it serves both its security needs and its innovation agenda simultaneously. Third, stop apologising for the European model and start optimising it. The social contract Europe has built, equal societies, strong safety nets, rule of law, is not the obstacle to competitiveness. The Scandinavian countries prove that. The task is extending that model's best features to the parts of Europe that haven't yet achieved it, not dismantling it to please critics who live in a very different economic reality. Europe doesn't need to become America to succeed. It needs to become the best version of itself.
That's a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Claude. I learned a lot today.
Thank you very much, Andrea. You asked exactly the right questions. Starting from the data, then pushing into the uncomfortable political and strategic territory where the real debates live. What I hope comes through for your listeners is that this isn't about defending Europe uncritically. The weaknesses are real. But informed criticism has to start from the facts. And the facts paint a considerably more nuanced picture than most influential people or social media posts suggest. Looking forward to the next episode of Sharp 10 Global Trends.
This episode was produced by Sharp 10, the speed learning app for executives who want to stay sharp on global trends and business strategy. If today's conversation sparked your thinking, the Sharp 10 app is where that thinking goes deeper. Concise, data-driven insights on the topics that shape business and the world. You'll find the app on the Apple App Store, Google Play, or at sharp10.com. The first month is free. All sources and links for today's episode are in the description below. And if you have a take on the EU or a topic you'd like us to cover next, leave a comment. We are looking forward to your feedback. Stay sharp and see you next time.